Side 3. Disclosure by Michael Crichton. Continuing on page 93. She still had perfect breasts, the nipples hard under his touch. She moaned, her body squirming as she straddled him. He felt her warmth. He began to hear a buzzing in his ears, a suffusing, intoxicated flush in his face. As sounds went dull, the room seemed distant, and there was nothing but this woman and her body and his desire for her. In that moment he felt a burst of anger, a kind of male fury, that he was pinned down, that she was dominating him, and he wanted to be in control, to take her. He sat up and grabbed her hair roughly, lifting her head and twisting his body. She looked in his eyes and saw instantly. "Yes," she said, and she moved sideways so he could sit up beside her. He slipped his hand between her legs. He felt warmth and lacy underpants. He tugged at them. She wriggled, helping him, and he slid them down to her knees. Then she kicked them away. Her hands were caressing his hair, her lips at his ear. "Yes," she whispered fiercely, "yes." Her blue skirt was bunched up around her waist. He kissed her hard, pulling her blouse wide, pressing her breasts to his bare chest. He felt her heat all along his body. He moved his fingers, probing between her lips. She gasped as they kissed, nodding her head, "yes." Then his fingers were in her. For a moment he was startled. She was not very wet, and then he remembered that, too. The way she would start, her words and body immediately passionate, but the central part of her slower to respond, taking her eventual arousal from his. She was always turned on most by his desire for her, and always came after he did, sometimes within a few seconds, but sometimes he struggled to stay hard while she rocked against him, pushing to her own completion, lost in her own private world while he was fading. He always felt alone, always felt as if she were using him. Those memories gave him pause, and she sensed his hesitation and grabbed him fiercely, fumbling at his belt, moaning, sticking her hot tongue in his ear. But reluctance was seeping back into him now. His angry heat was fading, and unbidden the thought flashed through his mind. "It's not worth it." All his feelings shifted again, and now he had a familiar sensation. Going back to see an old lover, being attracted over dinner, then getting involved again, feeling desire, and suddenly, in the heat of the moment, in the press of flesh, being reminded of all the things that had been wrong with the relationship, feeling old conflicts and angers and irritations rise up again, and wishing that he had never started. Suddenly thinking of how to get out of it, how to stop what was started. But usually there was no way to get out of it. Still, his fingers were inside her, and she was moving her body against his hand, shifting to be sure he would touch the right place. She was wetter, her lips were swelling. She opened her legs wider for him. She was breathing very hard, stroking him with her fingers. "Oh, God, I love the way you feel," she said. Usually, there was no way to get out of it. His body was tense and ready. Her hard nipples brushed against his chest. Her fingers caressed him. She licked the bottom of his earlobe with a quick dart of her tongue, and instantly there was nothing but his desire, hot and angry, more intense for the fact that he didn't really want to be there, that he felt she had manipulated him to this place. Now he would fuck her. He wanted to fuck her, hard. She sensed his change and moaned, no longer kissing him, leaning back on the couch, waiting. She watched him through half-closed eyes, nodding her head. His fingers still touched her, rapidly, repeatedly, making her gasp, and he turned, pushed her down on her back on the couch. She hiked up her skirt and spread her legs for him. He crouched over her, and she smiled at him, a knowing, victorious smile. It made him furious to see this sense that she had somehow won. This watchful detachment. And he wanted to catch her, to make her feel as out of control as he felt, to make her part of this, to wipe that smug detachment from her face. He spread her lips, but did not enter her. He held back, his fingers moving, teasing her. She arched her back, waiting for him. "No, no, please." Still he waited, looking at her. His anger was fading as quickly as it had come, his mind drifting away, the old reservations returning. In an instant of harsh clarity, he saw himself in the room, a panting, middle-aged, married man with his trousers down around his knees, bent over a woman on an office couch that was too small. What the hell was he doing? He looked at her face, saw the way the makeup cracked at the corners of her eyes, around her mouth. She had her hands on his shoulders, tugging him toward her. Oh, please. No. No. And then she turned her head aside and coughed. Something snapped in him. He sat back coldly. You're right. He got off the couch and pulled up his trousers. We shouldn't do this. She sat up. What are you doing? She seemed puzzled. You want this as much as I do. You know you do. No, he said. We shouldn't do this, Meredith. He was buckling his belt, stepping back. She stared at him in dazed disbelief, like someone awakened from sleep. You're not serious. This isn't a good idea. I don't feel good about it. And then her eyes were suddenly furious. You fucking son of a bitch! She got off the couch fast, rushing at him, hitting him hard with bunched fists. You bastard, you prick, you fucking bastard! He was trying to button his shirt, turning away from her blows. You shit, you bastard! She moved around him as he turned away, grabbing his hands, tearing at his shirt to keep him from buttoning it. You can't do this to me! Buttons popped. She scratched him, long red welts running down his chest. He turned again, avoiding her, wanting only to get out of there. To get dressed and get out of there. She pounded his back. You fucker, you can't leave me like this. Cut it out, Meredith, he said. It's over. Fuck you. She grabbed a handful of his hair, pulling him down with surprising strength, and she bit his ear hard. He felt an intense shooting pain, and he pushed her away roughly. She toppled backward, off balance, crashing against the glass coffee table, sprawling on the ground. She sat there, panting. You fucking son of a bitch. Meredith, just leave me alone. He was buttoning his shirt again. All he could think was, get out of here. Get your stuff and get out of here. He reached for his jacket, then saw his cellular phone on the windowsill. He moved around the couch and picked up the phone. The wine glass crashed against the window near his head. He looked over and saw her standing in the middle of the room, reaching for something else to throw. I'll kill you, she said. I'll fucking kill you. That's enough, Meredith, he said. The hell? She threw a small paper bag at him. It thunked against the glass and dropped to the floor. A box of condoms fell out. I'm going home. He moved toward the door. That's right, she said. You go home to your wife and your little fucking family. Alarms went off in his head. He hesitated for a moment. Oh, yes, she said, seeing him pause. I know all about you, you asshole. Your wife isn't fucking you, so you come in here and lead me on. You set me up, and then you walk out on me, you hostile, violent fucking asshole. You think you can treat women this way? You asshole. He reached for the doorknob. You walk out on me, you're dead. He looked back and saw her leaning unsteadily on the desk, and he thought, she's drunk. Good night, Meredith, he said. He twisted the knob, then remembered that the door had been locked. He unlocked the door and walked out without looking back. In the outer room, a cleaning woman was emptying trash baskets from the assistants' desks. I'll fucking kill you for this, Meredith called after him. The cleaning woman heard it and stared at Sanders. He looked away from her and walked straight to the elevator. He pushed the button. A moment later, he decided to take the stairs. Sanders stared at the setting sun from the deck of the ferry going back to Winslow. The evening was calm, with almost no breeze. The surface of the water was dark and still. He looked back at the lights of the city and tried to assess what had happened. From the ferry, he could see the upper floors of the Digicom buildings rising behind the horizontal gray concrete of the viaduct that ran along the water's edge. He tried to pick out Meredith's office window, but he was already too far away. Out here in the water, heading home to his family, slipping back into his familiar daily routine, the events of the previous hour had already begun to take on an unreal quality. He found it hard to believe that it had happened. He reviewed the events in his mind, trying to see just where he had gone wrong. He felt certain that it was all his fault, that he had misled Meredith in some important way. Otherwise, she would never have come on to him. The whole episode was an embarrassment for him, and probably for her, too. He felt guilty and miserable, and deeply uneasy about the future. What would happen now? What would she do? He couldn't even guess. He realized then that he didn't really know her at all, They had once been lovers, but that was a long time ago. Now she was a new person with new responsibilities. She was a stranger to him. Although the evening was mild, he felt chilled. He went back inside the ferry. He sat in a booth and took out his phone to call Susan. He pushed the buttons, but the light didn't come on. The battery was dead. For a moment he was confused. The battery should last all day, but it was dead. The perfect end to his day. Feeling the throb of the ferry engines, he stood in the bathroom and stared at himself in the mirror. His hair was messed. There was a faint smear of lipstick on his lips and another on his neck. Two buttons of his shirt were missing and his clothes were rumpled. It looked as if he had just gotten laid. He turned his head to see his ear. A tiny bruise marked where she had bitten him. He unbuttoned the shirt and looked at the deep red scratches running in parallel rows down his chest. Christ! How was he going to keep Susan from seeing this? He dampened paper towels and scrubbed away the lipstick. He patted down his hair and buttoned his sport coat, hiding most of his shirt. Then he went back outside, sat down at a booth by the window, and stared into space. Hey, Tom! He looked up and saw John Perry, his neighbor on Bainbridge. Perry was a lawyer with Marlin Howard, one of the oldest firms in Seattle. He was one of those irrepressibly enthusiastic people, and Sanders didn't much feel like talking to him. But Perry slipped into the seat opposite him. How's it going? Perry asked cheerfully. Pretty good, Sanders said. I had a great day. Glad to hear it. Just great, Perry said. We tried a case, and I tell you, we kicked ass. Great, Sanders said. He stared fixedly out the window, hoping Perry would take the hint and go away. Perry didn't. Yeah, and it was a damned tough case, too. Uphill all the way for us, he said. Title VII, Federal Court. Clients, a woman who worked at Microtech, claimed she wasn't promoted because she was a female. Not a very strong case, to tell the truth, because she drank and so on. There were problems, but we have a gal in our firm, Louise Fernandez, a Hispanic gal, and she is just lethal on these discrimination cases. Lethal. Got the jury to award our client nearly $500,000. That Fernandez can work the case law like nothing you've ever seen. She's won 14 of her last 16 cases. She acts so sweet and demure, and inside, she's just ice. I tell you, sometimes women scare the hell out of me. Sanders said nothing. He came home to a silent house, the kids already asleep. Susan always put the kids to bed early. He went upstairs. His wife was sitting up in bed, reading, with legal files and papers scattered across the bed covers. When she saw him, she got out of bed and came over to hug him. Involuntarily, his body tensed. I'm really sorry, Tom, she said. I'm sorry about this morning, and I'm sorry about what happened at work. She turned her face up and kissed him lightly on the lips. Awkwardly, he turned away. He was afraid she would smell Meredith's perfume, or... You mad about this morning? She asked. No, he said. Really, I'm not. It was just a long day. A lot of meetings on the merger? Yes, he said. And more tomorrow. It's pretty crazy. Susan nodded. It must be. You just got a call from the office. From a Meredith Johnson. He tried to keep his voice casual. Oh, yes? Uh-huh, about 10 minutes ago. She got back into bed. Who is she, anyway? Susan was always suspicious when women from the office called. Sanders said, She's the new Veep. They just brought her up from Cupertino. I wondered, she acted like she knew me. I don't think you've ever met. He waited, hoping he wouldn't have to say more. Well, she said, she sounded very friendly. She said to tell you everything is fine for the due diligence meeting tomorrow morning at 8:30, and she'll see you then. Okay, fine. He kicked off his shoes and started to unbutton his shirt, then stopped. He bent over and picked his shoes up. How old is she? Susan asked. Meredith? I don't know. 35, something like that. Why? Just wondered. I'm going to take a shower, he said. Okay. She picked up her legal briefs and settled back in bed, adjusting the reading light. He started to leave. Do you know her? Susan asked. I've met her before, in Cupertino. What's she doing up here? She's my new boss. She's the one. Yeah, he said. She's the one. She's the woman that's close to Garvin? Yeah. Who told you? Adele? Adele Lewin, Mark's wife, was one of Susan's best friends. She nodded. Marianne called, too. The phone never stopped ringing. I'll bet. So is Garvin fucking her, or what? Nobody knows, he said. The general belief is that he's not. Why'd he bring her in, instead of giving the job to you? I don't know, Sue. You didn't talk to Garvin? He came around to see me in the morning, but I wasn't there. She nodded. You must be pissed. Or are you being your usual understanding self? Well, he shrugged. What can I do? You can quit, she said. Not a chance. They passed over you. Don't you have to quit? This isn't the best economy to find another job, and I'm 41. I don't feel like starting over. Besides, Phil insists they're going to spin off the technical division and take it public in a year. Even if I'm not running it, I'd still be a principal in that new company. And did he have details? He nodded. They'll vest us each 20,000 shares and options for 50,000 more, then options for another 50,000 shares each additional year. At? Usually it's 25 cents a share. And the stock will be offered at what? $5? At least. The IPO market is getting stronger. Then, say it goes to 10, maybe 20 if we're hot. There was a brief silence. He knew she was good at figures. No, she said finally. You can't possibly quit. He had done the calculations many times. At a minimum, Sanders would realize enough on his stock options to pay off his mortgage in a single payment. But if the stock went through the roof, it could be truly fantastic, somewhere between $5 and $14 million. That was why going public was the dream of anyone who worked in a technical company. He said, as far as I'm concerned, they can bring in Godzilla to manage that division, and I'll still stay at least 2 more years. And is that what they've done? Brought in Godzilla? He shrugged. I don't know. Do you get along with her? He hesitated. I'm not sure. I'm going to take a shower. Okay, she said. He glanced back at her. She was reading her notes again. After his shower, he plugged his phone into the charger unit on the sink and put on a t-shirt and boxer shorts. He looked at himself in the mirror. The shirt covered his scratches. But he was still worried about the smell of Meredith's perfume. He splashed aftershave on his cheeks. He went into his son's room to check on him. Matthew was snoring loudly, his thumb in his mouth. He had kicked down the covers. Sanders pulled them back up gently and kissed his forehead. Then he went into Eliza's room. At first he could not see her. His daughter had lately taken to burrowing under a barricade of covers and pillows when she slept. He tiptoed in and saw a small hand reach up and wave to him. He came forward. Why aren't you asleep, Lize? He whispered. I was having a dream, she said. But she didn't seem frightened. He sat on the edge of the bed and stroked her hair. What kind of a dream?
About the beast.
Uh-huh.
The beast was really a prince, but he was placed under a powerful spell by a chantress.
That's right. He stroked her hair.
Who turned him into a hideous beast.
She was quoting the movie almost verbatim. That's right, he said.
Why?
I don't know, Lize. That's the story.
Because he didn't give her shelter from the bitter cold?
She was quoting again.
Why didn't he, Dad?
I don't know, he said.
Because he had no love in his heart, she said.
Lize, it's time for sleep.
Give me a dream first, Dad.
Okay. There's a beautiful silver cloud hanging over your bed, and...
That dream's no good, Dad.
She was frowning at him. Okay. What kind of dream do you want?
With Kermit.
Okay. Kermit is sitting right here by your head, and he is going to watch over you all night.
And you too.
Yes, and me too. He kissed her forehead, and she rolled away to face the wall. As he left the room, he could hear her sucking her thumb loudly. He went back to the bedroom and pushed aside his wife's legal briefs to get into bed.
"Was she still awake?"
Susan asked. "I think she'll go to sleep. She wanted a dream. About Kermit." His wife nodded.
"Kermit is a very big deal now."
She didn't comment on his T-shirt. He slipped under the covers and felt suddenly exhausted. He lay back against the pillow and closed his eyes. He felt Susan picking up the briefs on the bed, and a moment later she turned off the light.
"Hmm," she said. "You smell good."
She snuggled up against him, pressing her face against his neck, and threw her leg over his side. This was her invariable overture, and it always annoyed him. He felt pinned down by her heavy leg. She stroked his cheek.
"Is that aftershave for me?"
"Oh, Susan." He sighed, exaggerating his fatigue.
"Because it works," she said, giggling.
Beneath the covers, she put her hand on his chest. He felt it slide down and slip under the T-shirt. He had a burst of sudden anger. What was the matter with her? She never had any sense about these things. She was always coming onto him at inappropriate times and places. He reached down and grabbed her hand.
"Something wrong?"
"I'm really tired, Sue." She stopped.
"Bad day, huh?"
she said sympathetically.
"Yeah, pretty bad."
She got up on one elbow and leaned over him. She stroked his lower lip with one finger.
"You don't want me to cheer you up?"
"I really don't."
"Not even a little?"
He sighed again.
"You sure?"
she asked teasingly.
"Really, really sure?"
And then she started to slide beneath the covers. He reached down and held her head with both hands.
"Susan, please, come on."
She giggled.
"It's only 8:30. You can't be that tired."
"I am."
"I bet you're not."
"Susan, damn it, I'm not in the mood."
"Okay, okay."
She pulled away from him. "But I don't know why you put on the aftershave if you're not interested."
"For Christ's sake."
"We hardly ever have sex anymore as it is."
"That's because you're always traveling."
It just slipped out.
"I'm not always traveling."
"You're gone a couple of nights a week."
"That's not always traveling. And besides, it's my job."
"I thought you were going to be more supportive of my job."
"I am supportive."
"Complaining is not supportive."
"Look, for Christ's sake," he said. "I come home early whenever you're out of town. I feed the kids. I take care of things so you don't have to worry."
"Sometimes," she said.
"And sometimes you stay late at the office, and the kids are with Consuela until all hours."
"Well, I have a job, too."
"So don't give me this take care of things crap," she said.
"You're not home anywhere near as much as I am. I'm the one who has two jobs, and mostly you do exactly what you want, just like every other fucking man in the world."
"Susan."
"Jesus, you come home early once in a while, and you act like a fucking martyr." She sat up and turned on her bedside light.
"Every woman I know works harder than any man."
"Susan, I don't want to fight."
"Sure, make it my fault. I'm the one with the problem."
"Fucking men." He was tired, but he felt suddenly energized by anger. He felt suddenly strong and got out of bed and started pacing. "What does being a man have to do with it? Am I going to hear how oppressed you are again now?"
"Listen," she said, sitting straighter, "women are oppressed. It's a fact."
"Is it? How are you oppressed? You never wash a load of clothes. You never cook a meal. You never sweep a floor. Somebody does all that for you. You have somebody to do everything for you. You have somebody to take the kids to school and somebody to pick them up. You're a partner in a law firm, for Christ's sake. You're about as oppressed as Leona Helmsley." She was staring at him in astonishment. He knew why. Susan had made her oppression speech many times before, and he had never contradicted her. Over time, with repetition, it had become an accepted idea in their marriage. Now he was disagreeing. He was changing the rules.
"I can't believe you. I thought you were different."
She squinted at him, her judicious look.
"This is because a woman got your job, isn't it?"
"What are we going to do now, the fragile male ego?"
"It's true, isn't it? You're threatened."
"No, it's not. It's crap. Who's got the fragile ego around here? Your ego's so fucking fragile you can't even take a rejection in bed without picking a fight. That stopped her. He saw it instantly. She had no comeback. She sat there frowning at him, her face tight. Jesus, he said, and turned to leave the room.
You picked this fight, she said.
He turned back.
I did not.
Yes, you did. You were the one who started in with the traveling. No, you were complaining about no sex.
I was commenting.
Christ, never marry a lawyer.
And your ego is fragile.
Susan, you want to talk fragile? I mean, you're so fucking self-involved that you had a shit fit this morning because you wanted to look pretty for the pediatrician.
Oh, there it is. Finally, you are still mad because I made you late. What is it? You think you didn't get the job because you were late?
No, he said. I didn't.
You didn't get the job, she said, because Garvin didn't give it to you. You didn't play the game well enough, and somebody else played it better. That's why. A woman played it better.
Furious, shaking, unable to speak, he turned on his heel and left the room.
That's right, leave, she said. Walk away. That's what you always do. Walk away. Don't stand up for yourself. You don't want to hear it, Tom, but it's the truth. If you didn't get the job, you have nobody to blame but yourself.
He slammed the door.
He sat in the kitchen in darkness. It was quiet all around him, except for the hum of the refrigerator.
Through the kitchen window, he could see the moonlight on the bay through the stand of fir trees. He wondered if Susan would come down, but she didn't. He got up and walked around, pacing. After a while, it occurred to him that he hadn't eaten. He opened the refrigerator door, squinting in the light. It was stacked with baby food, juice containers, baby vitamins, bottles of formula. He poked among the stuff, looking for some cheese or maybe a beer. He couldn't find anything except a can of Susan's Diet Coke.
Christ, he thought. Not like the old days. When his refrigerator was full of frozen food and chips and salsa and lots of beer. His bachelor days.
He took out the Diet Coke. Now Eliza was starting to drink it, too. He'd told Susan a dozen times he didn't want the kids to get diet drinks. They ought to be getting healthy food. Real food. But Susan was busy, and Consuela indifferent. The kids ate all kinds of crap. It wasn't right. It wasn't the way he had been brought up. Nothing to eat. Nothing in his own damned refrigerator.
Hopeful, he lifted the lid of a Tupperware container and found a partially eaten peanut butter and jelly sandwich with Eliza's small tooth marks in one side. He picked the sandwich up and turned it over, wondering how old it was. He didn't see any mold.
What the hell, he thought, and he ate the rest of Eliza's sandwich, standing there in his T-shirt in the light of the refrigerator door. He was startled by his own reflection in the glass of the oven. Another privileged member of the patriarchy, lording it over the manor.
Christ, he thought, where did women come up with this crap?
He finished the sandwich and rubbed the crumbs off his hands. The wall clock said 9:15. Susan went to sleep early. Apparently she wasn't coming down to make up. She usually didn't. It was his job to make up. He was the peacemaker. He opened a carton of milk and drank from it, then put it back on the wire shelf. He closed the door. Darkness again. He walked over to the sink, washed his hands, and dried them on a dish towel. Having eaten a little, he wasn't so angry anymore. Fatigue crept over him. He looked out the window and through the trees and saw the lights of a ferry heading west toward Bremerton. One of the things he liked about this house was that it was relatively isolated. It had some land around it. It was good for the kids. Kids should grow up with a place to run and play. He yawned. She definitely wasn't coming down. It'd have to wait until morning. He knew how it would go. He'd get up first, fix her a cup of coffee, and take it to her in bed. Then he'd say he was sorry, and she would reply that she was sorry, too. They'd hug, and he would go get dressed for work, and that would be it. He went back up the dark stairs to the second floor and opened the door to the bedroom. He could hear the quiet rhythms of Susan's breathing. He slipped into bed and rolled over on his side, and then he went to sleep.
Tuesday.
It rained in the morning, hard sheets of drumming downpour that slashed across the windows of the ferry. Sanders stood in line to get his coffee, thinking about the day to come. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Dave Benedict coming toward him and quickly turned away, but it was too late. Benedict waved. Hey, guy. Sanders didn't want to talk about Digicon this morning. At the last moment, he was saved by a call. The phone in his pocket went off. He turned away to answer it.
Fucking A, Tommy boy.
It was Eddie Larson in Austin.
What is it, Eddie? You know that bean counter Cupertino sent down? Well, get this. There's 8 of them here now. Independent accounting firm of Jenkins McKay out of Dallas. They're going over all the books, like a swarm of roaches. And I mean everything. Receivables, payables, A&Ls, year-to-date, everything. And now they're going back through every year to 89.
Yeah? Disrupting everything?
Better believe it. The gals don't even have a place to sit down and answer the phone. Plus, everything from 91 back is in storage downtown. We've got it on fiche here, but they say they want original documents. They want the damned paper. And they get all squinty and paranoid when they order us round, treating us like we're thieves or something trying to pull a fast one. It's insulting.
Well, Sanders said, hang in there. You've got to do what they ask.
The only thing that really bothers me, Eddie said, is they got another 7 more coming in this afternoon, because they're also doing a complete inventory of the plant. Everything from the furniture in the offices to the air handlers and the heat stampers out on the line. We got a guy there now making his way down the line, stopping at each workstation. Says, what's this thing called? How do you spell it? Who makes it? What's the model number? How old is it? Where's the serial number? You ask me, we might as well shut the line down for the rest of the day.
Sanders frowned. They're doing an inventory?
Well, that's what they call it, but it's beyond any damn inventory I ever heard of. These guys have worked over at Texas Instruments or someplace, and I'll give them one thing. They know what they're talking about. This morning, one of the Jenkins guys came up and asked me what kind of glass we got in the ceiling skylights. I said, what kind of glass? I thought he was shitting me. He says, yeah, is it Corning 247 or 247/9 or some damn thing like that? They're different kinds of UV glass because UV can affect chips on the production line. I never even heard that UV can affect chips.
Oh, yeah, this guy says. Real problem if your ASDs get over 220. That's annual sunny days.
Have you heard of that?
Sanders wasn't really listening. He was thinking about what it meant that somebody, either Garvin or the Conley White people, would ask for an inventory of the plant. Ordinarily, you called for an inventory only if you were planning to sell a facility. Then you had to do it, to figure your write-downs at the time of transfer of assets, and...
Tom, you there?
I'm here.
So I say to this guy, I never heard that, about the UV and the chips, and we've been putting chips in the phones for years, never any trouble. And then the guy says, oh, not for installing chips, UV affects it if you're manufacturing chips. And I say, we don't do that here. And he says, I know. So I'm wondering, what the hell does he care what kind of glass we have? Tommy boy, you with me? What's the story?
Larson said.
We're going to have 15 guys crawling all over us by the end of the day. Now, don't tell me this is routine.
It doesn't sound like it's routine, no.
It sounds like they're going to sell the plant to somebody who makes chips, is what it sounds like, and that ain't us.
I agree. That's what it sounds like.
Fucking A, Eddie said. I thought you told me this wasn't going to happen. Tom, people here are getting upset, and I'm one of them.
I understand.
I mean, I got people asking me. They just bought a house. Their wife's pregnant. They got a baby coming, and they want to know. What do I tell them?
Eddie, I don't have any information.
Jesus, Tom, you're the division head.
I know. Let me check with Cork, see what the accountants did there. They were out there last week.
I already talked to Colin an hour ago. Operations sent 2 people out there for 1 day. Very polite. Not like this at all.
No inventory?
No inventory.
Okay, Sanders said. He sighed. Let me get into it.
Tommy boy, Eddie said, I got to tell you right out. I'm concerned you don't already know.
Me too, Sanders said. Me too. He hung up the phone. Sanders pushed KAP for Stephanie Kaplan. She would know what was going on in Austin, and he thought she would tell him. But her assistant said Kaplan was out of the office for the rest of the morning. He called Mary Ann, but she was gone too. Then he dialed the Four Seasons Hotel and asked for Max Dorfman. The operator said Mr. Dorfman's lines were busy. He made a mental note to see Max later in the day. Because if Eddie was right, then Sanders was out of the loop. And that wasn't good. In the meantime, he could bring up the plant closing with Meredith at the conclusion of the morning meeting with Conley White. That was the best he could do for the moment. The prospect of talking to her made him uneasy, but he'd get through it somehow. He didn't really have a choice. When he got to the fourth-floor conference room, nobody was there. At the far end, a wallboard showed a cutaway of the Twinkle Drive and a schematic for the Malaysia assembly line. There were notes scribbled on some of the pads, open briefcases beside some of the chairs. The meeting was already underway. Sanders had a sense of panic. He started to sweat. At the far end of the room, an assistant came in and began moving around the table, setting out glasses and water. "Where is everybody?" he asked.
"Oh, they left about 15 minutes ago," she said.
15 minutes ago? When did they start?
The meeting started at 8.
8? Sanders said. I thought it was supposed to be 8:30.
No, the meeting started at 8.
Damn. Where are they now?
Meredith took everybody down to VIE to demo the corridor.
Entering VIE, the first thing Sanders heard was laughter. When he walked into the equipment room, he saw that Don Cherry's team had two of the Conley White executives up on the system. John Conley, the young lawyer, and Jim Daly, the investment banker, were both wearing headsets while they walked on the rolling walker pads. The two men were grinning wildly. Everyone else in the room was laughing, too, including the normally sour-faced CFO of Conley White, Ed Nichols, who was standing beside a monitor which showed an image of the virtual corridor that the users were seeing. Nichols had red marks on his forehead from wearing the headset. Nichols looked over as Sanders came up.
"This is fantastic."
Sanders said, "Yes, it's pretty spectacular."
"Simply fantastic. It's going to wipe out all the criticism in New York once they see this. We've been asking Don if he can run this on our own corporate database."
"No problem," Cherry said. "Just get us the programming hooks for your DB and we'll plug you right in. Take us about an hour."
Nichols pointed to the headset.
"And we can get one of these contraptions in New York?"
"Easy," Cherry said. "We can ship it out later today. It'll be there Thursday. I'll send one of our people to set it up for you."
"This is going to be a great selling point," Nichols said. "Just great."
He took out his half-frame glasses. They were a complicated kind of glasses that folded up very small. Nichols unfolded them carefully and put them on his nose. On the walker pad, John Conley was laughing.
"Angel," he said, "how do I open this drawer?"
Then he cocked his head, listening.
"He's talking to the help angel," Cherry said. "He hears the angel through his earphones."
"What's the angel telling him?" Nichols said.
"That's between him and his angel," Cherry laughed.
On the walker pad, Conley nodded as he listened, then reached forward into the air with his hand. He closed his fingers as if gripping something and pulled back, pantomiming someone opening a file drawer. On the monitor, Sanders saw a virtual file drawer slide out from the wall of the corridor. Inside the drawer, he saw neatly arranged files.
"Wow," Conley said. "This is amazing. Angel, can I see a file?"
"Oh, okay."
Conley reached out and touched one of the file labels with his fingertip. Immediately, the file popped out of the drawer and opened up, apparently hanging in midair.
"We have to break the physical metaphor sometimes," Cherry said, "because users have only one hand, and you can't open a regular file with one hand."
Standing on the black walker pad, Conley moved his hand through the air in short arcs, mimicking someone turning pages with his hand. On the monitor, Sanders saw Conley was actually looking at a series of spreadsheets.
"Hey," Conley said, "you people ought to be more careful. I have all your financial records here."
"Let me see that," Daly said, turning around on the walker pad to look. "You guys look all you want," Cherry laughed. "Enjoy it while you can. In the final system, we'll have safeguards built into control access. But for now, we bypass the entire system. Do you notice that some of the numbers are red? That means they have more detail stored away. Touch one."
Conley touched a red number. The numbers zoomed out, creating a new plane of information that hung in the air above the previous spreadsheet.
"Wow."
Kind of a hypertext thing, Sherry said with a shrug. Sort of neat, if I say so myself.
Conley and Daly were giggling, poking rapidly at numbers on the spreadsheet, zooming out dozens of detail sheets that now hung in the air all around them.
Hey, how do you get rid of all this stuff?
Can you find the original spreadsheet?
It's hidden behind all this other stuff.
Bend over and look. See if you can get it.
Conley bent at the waist and appeared to look under something. He reached out and pinched air.
I got it.
Okay, now you see a green arrow in the right corner. Touch it.
Conley touched it. All the papers zoomed back into the original spreadsheet.
Fabulous.
I want to do it, Daly said. No, you can't. I'm going to do it.
No, me. Me.
They were laughing like delighted kids. Blackburn came up.
I know this is enjoyable for everyone, he said to Nichols, but we're falling behind our schedule, and perhaps we ought to go back to the conference room.
All right, Nichols said with obvious reluctance. He turned to Cherry.
You sure you can get us one of these things?
Count on it, Cherry said. Count on it.
Walking back to the conference room, the Conley White executives were in a giddy mood. They talked rapidly, laughing about the experience. The Digicom people walked quietly beside them, not wanting to disrupt the good mood. It was at that point that Mark Lewin fell into step alongside Sanders and whispered,
Hey, why didn't you call me last night?
I did, Sanders said. Lewin shook his head.
There wasn't any message when I got home, he said.
I talked to your answering machine about 6:15.
I never got a message, Lewin said. And then when I came in this morning, you weren't here.
He lowered his voice.
Christ, what a mess. I had to go into the meeting on Twinkle with no idea what the approach was going to be.
I'm sorry, Sanders said. I don't know what happened.
Fortunately, Meredith took over the discussion, Lewin said. Otherwise, I would have been in deepest shit. In fact, I...
We'll do this later, he said, seeing Johnson drop back to talk to Sanders. Lewin stepped away.
Where the hell were you?
Johnson said. I thought the meeting was for 8:30.
I called your house last night, specifically because it was changed to 8. They're trying to catch a plane to Austin for the afternoon, so we moved everything up.
I didn't get that message.
I talked to your wife. Didn't she tell you?
I thought it was 8:30. Johnson shook her head, as if dismissing the whole thing.
Anyway, she said, in the 8 o'clock session, I had to take another approach to Twinkle, and it's very important that we have some coordination in the light of...
Meredith? Up at the front of the group, Garvin was looking back at her. Meredith, John has a question for you.
Be right there, she said.
With a final angry frown at Sanders, she hurried up to the head of the group. Back in the conference room, the mood was light. They were all still joking as they took their seats. Ed Nichols began the meeting by turning to Sanders.
Meredith's been bringing us up to date on the Twinkle Drive. Now that you're here, we'd like your assessment as well.
I had to take another approach to Twinkle,
Meredith had said. Sanders hesitated.
My assessment?
Yes, Nichols said. You're in charge of Twinkle, aren't you? Sanders looked at the faces around the table, turned expectantly toward him. He glanced at Johnson, but she had opened her briefcase and was rummaging through her papers, taking out several bulging manila envelopes.
Well, Sanders said, we built several prototypes and tested them thoroughly. There's no doubt that the prototypes performed flawlessly. They're the best drives in the world.
I understand that, Nichols said, but now you're in production. Isn't that right?
That's right.
I think we're more interested in your assessment of the production. Sanders hesitated.
What had she told them?
At the other end of the room, Meredith Johnson closed her briefcase, folded her hands under her chin, and stared steadily at him. He could not read her expression.
What had she told them?
Mr. Sanders? Well, Sanders began, we've been shaking out the lines, dealing with the problems as they arise. It's pretty standard startup experience for us. We're still in the early stages.
I'm sorry, Nichols said. I thought you'd been in production for 2 months.
Yes, that's true. 2 months doesn't sound like the early stages to me.
Well, some of your product cycles are as short as 9 months, isn't that right?
9 to 18 months, yes.
Then, after 2 months, you must be in full production. How do you assess that as the principal person in charge?
Well, I'd say the problems are of the order of magnitude we generally experience at this point.
I'm interested to hear that, Nichols said, because earlier today, Meredith indicated to us that the problems were actually quite serious. She said you might even have to go back to the drawing board.
Shit. How should he play it now? He'd already said that the problems were not so bad. He couldn't back down. Sanders took a breath and said, I hope I haven't conveyed the wrong impression to Meredith, because I have full confidence in our ability to manufacture the Twinkle Drive.
I'm sure you do, Nichols said, but we're looking down the barrel at competition from Sony and Philips, and I'm not sure that a simple expression of your confidence is adequate. How many of the drives coming off the line meet specifications?
I don't have that information.
Just approximately.
I wouldn't want to say without precise figures.
Are precise figures available?
Yes, I just don't have them at hand. Nichols frowned. His expression said, why don't you have them when you knew this is what the meeting was about? Conley cleared his throat. Meredith indicated that the line is running at 29% capacity and that only 5% of the drives meet specifications. Is that your understanding? That's more or less how it has been. Yes. There was a brief silence around the table. Abruptly, Nichols sat forward.
I'm afraid I need some help here, he said. With figures like that, on what do you base your confidence in the Twinkle Drive?
The reason is that we've seen all this before, Sanders replied. We've seen production problems that look insurmountable, but then get resolved quickly.
I see. So you think your past experience will hold true here?
Yes, I do. Nichols sat back in his seat and crossed his arms over his chest. He looked extremely dissatisfied. Jim Daly, the thin investment banker, sat forward and said,
Please don't misunderstand, Tom. We're not trying to put you on the spot, he said. We have long ago identified several reasons for acquisition of this company, irrespective of any specific problem with Twinkle. So I don't think Twinkle is a critical issue today. We just want to know where we stand on it, and we'd like you to be as frank as possible.
Well, there are problems, Sanders said. We're in the midst of assessing them now. We have some ideas, but some of the problems may go back to design. Daly said, Give us worst case. Worst case? We pull the line, rework the housings and perhaps the controller chips, and then go back on.
Causing a delay of?
9 to 12 months. Up to 6 months, Sanders said.
Jesus,
somebody whispered. Daly said,
Johnson suggested that the maximum delay would be 6 weeks.
I hope that's right, but you asked for worst case.
Do you really think it will take 6 months?
You asked for worst case. I think it's unlikely.
But possible?
Yes, possible. Nichols sat forward again and gave a big sigh.
Let me see if I understand this right. If there are design problems with the drive, they occurred under your stewardship. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. Nichols shook his head.
Well, having gotten us into this mess, do you really think you're the person to clean it up?
Sanders suppressed a surge of anger.
Yes, I do, he said.
In fact, I think I'm the best possible person to do it. As I said, we've seen this kind of situation before, and we've handled it before. I'm close to all the people involved, and I am sure we can resolve it. He wondered how he could explain to these people in suits the reality of how products were made.
When you're working the cycles, he said, it's sometimes not so serious to go back to the boards. Nobody likes to do it, but it may have advantages. In the old days, we made a complete generation of new products every year or so. Now, more and more, we also make incremental changes within generations. If we have to redo the chips, we may be able to code in the video compression algorithms which weren't available when we started. That will enhance the end-user perception of speed by more than the simple drive specs. We won't go back to build a 100-millisecond drive. We'll go back to build an 80-millisecond drive.
But, Nichols said, in the meantime, you won't have entered the market.
No, that's true.
you won't have established your brand name or established market share for your product stream. You won't have your dealerships or your OEMs or your ad campaign because you won't have a product line to support it. You may have a better drive, but it'll be an unknown drive. You'll be starting from scratch.
All true, but the market responds fast.
And so does the competition. Where will Sony be by the time you get to market? Will they be at 80 milliseconds, too?
I don't know, Sanders said. Nichols sighed.
I wish I had more confidence about where we are on this thing,
to say nothing of whether we're properly staffed to fix it.
Meredith spoke for the first time.
I may be a little bit at fault here, she said. When you and I spoke about Twinkle, Tom, I understood you to say that the problems were quite serious.
They are, yes.
Well, I don't think we want to be covering anything up here.
He said quickly, I'm not covering anything up.
The words came out almost before he realized it. He heard his voice high-pitched, tight. No, no, Meredith said soothingly. I didn't mean to suggest you were. It's just that these technical issues are hard for some of us to grasp. We're looking for a translation into layman's terms of just where we are, if you can do that for us.
I've been trying to do that, he said. He knew he sounded defensive, but he couldn't help it.
Yes, Tom, I know you have, Meredith said,
her voice still soothing.
But for example, if the laser read-write heads are out of sync with the M subset instructions off the controller chip, what is that going to mean for us, in terms of downtime?
She was just grandstanding, demonstrating her facility with tech talk, but her words threw him off balance anyway, because the laser heads were read-only, not read-write, and they had nothing to do with the M subset off the controller chip. The position controls all came off the X subset, and the X subset was licensed code from Sony, part of the driver code that every company used in their CD drives. To answer without embarrassing her, he had to move into fantasy, where nothing he could say was true.
Well, he said, you raise a good point, Meredith, but I think the M subset should be a relatively simple problem, assuming the laser heads are tracking to tolerance. Perhaps 3 or 4 days to fix.
He glanced quickly at Cherry and Lewin, the only people in the room who would know that Sanders had just spoken gibberish. Both men nodded sagely as they listened. Cherry even rubbed his chin.
Johnson said, And do you anticipate a problem with the asynchronous tracking signals from the motherboard?
Again, she was mixing everything up. The tracking signals came from the power source and were regulated by the controller chip. There wasn't a motherboard in the drive units. But by now he was in the swing. He answered quickly, That's certainly a consideration, Meredith, and we should check it thoroughly. I expect we'll find that the asynchronous signals may be phase-shifted, but nothing more than that.
A phase shift is easy to repair?
Yes, I think so. Nichols cleared his throat.
I feel this is an in-house technical issue, he said. Perhaps we should move on to other matters. What's next on the agenda?
Garvin said, We've scheduled a demo of the video compression just down the hall.
Fine, let's do that.
Chairs scraped back. Everyone stood up and they filed out of the room. Meredith was slower to close up her files. Sanders stayed behind for a moment, too.
When they were alone, he said, What the hell was all that about? All what?
All that gobbledygook about controller chips and read heads. You don't know what you were talking about.
Oh, yes, I do, she said angrily. I was fixing the mess that you made.
She leaned over the table and glared at him.
Look, Tom, I decided to take your advice last night and tell the truth about the drive. This morning I said there were severe problems with it, that you were very knowledgeable, and you would tell them what the problems were. I set it up for you to say what you told me you wanted to say, but then you came in and announced there were no problems of significance.
But I thought we agreed last night.
These men aren't fools, and we're not going to be able to fool them.
She snapped her briefcase shut.
I reported in good faith what you told me, and then you said I didn't know what I was talking about.
He bit his lip, trying to control his anger.
I don't know what you think is going on here, she said. These men don't care about technical details. They wouldn't know a drive head from a dildo.
They're just looking to see if anybody's in charge, if anybody has a handle on the problems. They want reassurance, and you didn't reassure them, so I had to jump in and fix it with a lot of techno bullshit. I had to clean up after you. I did the best I could. But let's face it, you didn't inspire confidence today, Tom. Not at all. God damn it, he said. You're just talking about appearances. Corporate appearances in a corporate meeting. But in the end, somebody has to actually build the damn drive. I'll say. And I've been running this division for 8 years and running it damn well.
Meredith?
Garvin stuck his head in the door. They both stopped talking.
We're waiting, Meredith, he said.
He turned and looked coldly at Sanders. She picked up her briefcase and swept out of the room. Sanders went immediately downstairs to Blackburn's office. I need to see Phil. Sandra, his assistant, sighed.
He's pretty busy today.
I need to see him now.
Let me check, Tom.
She buzzed the inner office.
Phil, it's Tom Sanders.
She listened a moment.
He says go right in.
Sanders went into Blackburn's office and closed the door. Blackburn stood up behind his desk and ran his hands down his chest.
Tom, I'm glad you came down.
They shook hands briefly. It isn't working out with Meredith, Sanders said at once. He was still angry from his encounter with her.
Yes, I know.
I don't think I can work with her. Blackburn nodded.
I know. She already told me.
Oh? What did she tell you?
She told me about the meeting last night, Tom.
Sanders frowned. He couldn't imagine that she had discussed that meeting.
Last night?
She told me that you sexually harassed her.
I what? Now, Tom, don't get excited. Meredith's assured me she's not going to press charges. We can handle it quietly, in-house. That will be best for everyone. In fact, I've just been going over the organization charts and...
Wait a minute, Sanders said. She's saying I harassed her? Blackburn stared at him.
Tom, we've been friends a long time. I can assure you this doesn't have to be a problem. It doesn't have to get around the company. Your wife doesn't need to know. As I said, we can handle this quietly, to the satisfaction of everyone involved.
Wait a minute. It's not true.
Tom, just give me a minute here, please. The most important thing now is for us to separate the two of you. So you aren't reporting to her. I think a lateral promotion for you would be ideal.
Lateral promotion?
Yes, there's an opening for a technical vice president in the cellular division in Austin. I want to transfer you there. You'll go with the same seniority, salary, and benefit package. Everything the same, except you'll be in Austin, and you won't have any direct contact with her. How does that sound?
Austin.
Yes.
Cellular.
Yes, beautiful weather, nice working conditions, university town. Chance to get your family out of this rain.
Sanders said, but Conley's going to sell off Austin. Blackburn sat down behind his desk.
I can't imagine where you heard that, Tom, he said calmly. It's completely untrue.
You sure about that?
Absolutely. Believe me, selling Austin is the last thing they'd do. Why, it makes no sense at all.
Then why are they inventorying the plant?
I'm sure they're going over the whole operation with a fine-tooth comb. Look, Tom, Conley's worried about cash flow after the acquisition, and the Austin plant is, as you know, very profitable. We've given them the figures. Now they're verifying them, making sure they're real. But there's no chance they would sell it. Cellular is only going to grow, Tom. You know that. And that's why I think a vice presidency there in Austin is an excellent career opportunity for you to consider.
But I'd be leaving the Advanced Products Division?
Well, yes. The whole point would be to move you out of this division.
And then I wouldn't be in the new company when it spins off.
That's true.
Sanders paced back and forth. That's completely unacceptable.
Well, let's not be hasty, Blackburn said. Let's consider all the ramifications.
Phil, he said, I don't know what she told you, but...
She told me the whole story.
But I think you should know...
And I want you to know, Tom, Blackburn said, that I don't have any judgment about what may have happened. That's not my concern or my interest.
I'm just trying to solve a difficult problem for the company.
Phil, listen. I didn't do it.
I understand that's probably how you feel, but...
I didn't harass her. She harassed me.
I'm sure, Blackburn said. It may have seemed like that to you at the time, but...
Phil, I'm telling you, she did everything but rape me.
He paced angrily.
Phil, she harassed me.
Blackburn sighed and sat back in his chair. He tapped his pencil on the corner of his desk.
I have to tell you frankly, Tom, I find that difficult to believe.
It's what happened.
Meredith's a beautiful woman, Tom, a very vital, sexy woman. I think it's natural for a man to lose control.
Phil, you aren't hearing me. She harassed me.
Blackburn gave a helpless shrug.
I hear you, Tom. I find that difficult to picture.
Well, she did. You want to hear what really happened last night?
Well,
Blackburn shifted in his chair.
Of course I want to hear your version. But the thing is, Tom, Meredith Johnson is very well connected in this company. She has impressed a lot of extremely important people.
You mean Garvin?
Not only Garvin. Meredith has built a power base in several areas.
Conley White?
Blackburn nodded.
Yes, there too.
You don't want to hear what I say happened?
Of course I do,
Blackburn said, running his hands through his hair.
Absolutely I do, and I want to be scrupulously fair. But I'm trying to tell you that no matter what, we're going to have to make some transfers here. And Meredith has important allies.
So it doesn't matter what I say.
Blackburn frowned, watching him pace.
I understand that you are upset. I can see that. And you're a valued person in this company. But what I'm trying to do here, Tom, is to get you to look at the situation.
What situation?
Sanders said.
Blackburn sighed. Were there any witnesses last night?
No.
So it's your word against hers.
I guess so.
In other words, it's a pissing match.
So? That's no reason to assume I'm wrong, and she's right.
Of course not, Blackburn said. But look at the situation. A man claiming sexual harassment against a woman is, well, pretty unlikely. I don't think there's ever been a case in this company. It doesn't mean it couldn't happen, but it does mean that it'd be very uphill for you, even if Meredith wasn't so well connected.
He paused.
I just don't want to see you get hurt in this.
I've already been hurt.
Again, we're talking about feelings here, conflicting claims, and unfortunately, Tom, no witnesses.
He rubbed his nose, tugged at his lapels.
You moved me out of the APD, and I'm hurt, because I won't get to be part of the new company, the company I worked on for 12 years.
That's an interesting legal position, Blackburn said.
I'm not talking about a legal position. I'm talking about...
Look, Tom, let me review this with Garvin. Meanwhile, why don't you go off and think this Austin offer over? Think about it carefully, because no one wins in a pissing match. You may hurt Meredith, but you'll hurt yourself much more. That's my concern here, as your friend.
If you were my friend,
Sanders began.
I am your friend, Blackburn said, whether you know it at this moment or not.
He stood up behind his desk.
You don't need this splashed all over the papers. Your wife doesn't need to hear about this, or your kids. You don't need to be the gossip of Bainbridge for the rest of the summer. That isn't going to do you any good at all.
I understand that, but...
But we have to face reality, Tom, Blackburn said. The company is faced with conflicting claims. What's happened has happened. We have to go on from here. And all I'm saying is, I'd like to resolve this quickly. So think it over, please, and get back to me.
After Sanders left, Blackburn called Garvin.
I just talked with him, he told Garvin.
And?
He says it was the other way around, that she harassed him.
Christ, Garvin said. What a mess.
Yes, but on the other hand, it's what you'd expect him to say, Blackburn said. It's the usual response in these cases. The man always denies it.
Yeah, well, this is dangerous, Phil.
I understand. I don't want this thing to blow up on us.
No, no.
There's nothing more important right now than getting this thing resolved.
I understand, Bob.
You made him the Austin offer?
Yes, he's thinking it over.
Will he take it?
My guess is no.
And did you push it?
Well, I tried to convey to him that we weren't going to back down on Meredith, that we were going to support her through this.
Damn right we are, Garvin said.
I think he was clear about that, so let's see what he says when he comes back to us.
He wouldn't go off and file, would he?
He's too smart for that.
We hope, Garvin said irritably, and hung up.
Look at the situation.
Sanders stood in Pioneer Park and leaned against a pillar, staring at the light drizzle. He was replaying the meeting with Blackburn. Blackburn hadn't even been willing to listen to Sanders' version. He hadn't let Sanders tell him. Blackburn already knew what had happened.
She's a very sexy woman. It's natural for a man to lose control.
That was what everyone at Digicom would think. Every single person in the company would have that view of what had happened. Blackburn had said he found it difficult to believe that Sanders had been harassed. Others would find it difficult, too. Blackburn had told him it didn't matter what happened. Blackburn was telling him that Johnson was well-connected and that nobody would believe a man had been harassed by a woman.
Look at the situation.
They were asking him to leave Seattle, leave the APG. No options, no big payoff. No return for his 12 long years of work. All that was gone. Austin, baking hot, dry, brand new. Susan would never accept it. Her practice in Seattle was successful. She had spent many years building it. They had just finished remodeling the house. The kids liked it here. If Sanders even suggested a move, Susan would be suspicious. She'd want to know what was behind it. And sooner or later, she would find out. If he accepted the transfer, he would be confirming his guilt to his wife. No matter how he thought about it, how he tried to put it together in his mind, Sanders could see no good outcome. He was being screwed.
I'm your friend, Tom, whether you know it right now or not.
He recalled the moment at his wedding when Blackburn, his best man, said he wanted to dip Susan's ring in olive oil because there was always a problem about getting it on the finger. Blackburn in a panic, in case some little moment in the ceremony went wrong.
That was Phil, always worried about appearances.
Your wife doesn't need to hear about this.
But Phil was screwing him. Phil and Garvin behind him. They were both screwing him.
Sanders had worked hard for the company for many years, but now they didn't give a damn about him. They were taking Meredith's side without any question. They didn't even want to hear his version of what had happened. As Sanders stood in the rain, his sense of shock slowly faded, and with it, his sense of loyalty. He started to get angry. He took out his phone and placed a call.
Mr. Perry's office?
It's Tom Sanders calling.
I'm sorry, Mr. Perry is in court. Can I give him a message?
Maybe you could help me. The other day he mentioned that you have a woman there who handles sexual harassment cases.
We have several attorneys who do that, Mr. Sanders.
He mentioned a Hispanic woman.
He was trying to remember what else Perry had said about her. Something about being sweet and demure?
He couldn't recall for sure.
That would be Miss Fernandez.
I wonder if you could connect me, Sanders said.
Fernandez's office was small, her desk stacked high with papers and legal briefs in neat piles, a computer terminal in the corner.
She stood up as he came in.
You must be Mr. Sanders.
She was a tall woman in her 30s with straight blonde hair and a handsome aquiline face. She was dressed in a pale cream-colored suit. She had a direct manner and a firm handshake.
I'm Louise Fernandez. How can I help you?
She wasn't at all what he had expected. She wasn't sweet and demure at all, and certainly not Hispanic. He was so startled that without thinking, he said,
You're not what I expected.
She raised an eyebrow.
My father's from Cuba. We left there when I was a child. Please sit down, Mr. Sanders.
She turned and walked back around her desk.
He sat down, feeling embarrassed.
Anyway, thank you for seeing me so quickly.
Not at all. You're John Perry's friend?
Yes, he mentioned the other day that you, specialized in these cases.
I do labor law, primarily constructive termination and Title VII suits.
I see.
He felt foolish that he had come. He was taken aback by her brisk manner and elegant appearance. In fact, she reminded him very much of Meredith. He felt certain that she would not be sympathetic to his case. She put on horn-rimmed glasses and peered at him across the desk.
Have you eaten? I can get you a sandwich if you like.
I'm not hungry, thanks. She pushed a half-eaten sandwich to the side of her desk.
I'm afraid I have a court appearance in an hour. Sometimes things get a bit rushed.
She got out a yellow legal pad and set it before her. Her movements were quick, decisive. Sanders watched her, sure she was the wrong person. He should never have come here. It was all a mistake. He looked around the office. There was a neat stack of bar charts for a courtroom appearance. Fernandez looked up from the pad, her pen poised. It was one of those expensive fountain pens.
Would you like to tell me the situation?
I'm not sure where to begin.
We could start with your full name and address, and your age.
Thomas Robert Sanders. He gave his address.
And your age?
41.
Occupation?
I'm a division manager at Digital Communications, the Advanced Products Division.
How long have you been at that company?
12 years.
Uh-huh.
And in your present capacity?
8 years. And why are you here today, Mr. Sanders?
I've been sexually harassed.
Uh-huh.
She showed no surprise. Her expression was completely neutral.
You want to tell me the circumstances?
My boss, came on to me.
And the name of your boss?
Meredith Johnson.
Is that a man or a woman?
A woman.
Uh-huh.
Again, no sign of surprise. She continued making notes steadily, the pen scratching.
When did this happen?
Last night.
What were the exact circumstances?
He decided not to mention the merger. She has just been appointed my new boss, and we had several things to go over. She asked if we could meet at the end of the day.
She requested this meeting?
Yes.
And where did the meeting take place?
In her office, at 6 o'clock.
Anybody else present?
No, her assistant came in briefly at the start of the meeting, then left, before anything happened.
I see. Go on.
We talked for a while about business, and we had some wine. She had gotten some wine. And then she came on to me. I was over by the window, and suddenly she started kissing me. Then pretty soon we were sitting on the couch, and then she started... He hesitated. How much detail do you want?
Just the broad strokes for now.
She bit her sandwich.
You say you were kissing?
Yes.
And she initiated this?
Yes.
What was your reaction when she did that?
I was uncomfortable. I'm married.
Uh-huh. What was the general atmosphere in the meeting prior to this kiss?
It was a regular business meeting. We were talking about business. But all the time, she was making suggestive remarks.
Like what?
Oh, about how good I looked, how I was in shape, how glad she was to see me.
How glad she was to see you?
Fernandez repeated with a puzzled look. Yes, we knew each other before.
You had a prior relationship?
Yes.
When was that?
10 years ago.
And were you married then?
No.
Did you both work for the same company at that time?
No, I did, but she worked for another company.
And how long did your relationship last?
About 6 months.
And have you kept up contact?
No, not really.
Any contact at all?
Once.
Intimate?
No, just, you know, hello in the hallway, at the office.
I see. In the last 8 years, have you ever been to her house or apartment?
No.
Dinners, drinks after work, anything?
No, I really haven't seen her at all. When she joined the company, she was in Cupertino in operations. I was in Seattle in Advanced Products. We didn't have much contact.
So, during this time, she wasn't your superior?
No.
Give me a picture of Ms. Johnson. How old?
35.
Would you characterize her as attractive?
Yes.
Very attractive?
She was a Miss Teenage something as a kid.
So you would say she's very attractive?
The pen scratched on the legal pad. Yes.
And how about other men? Would you say they find her very attractive?
Yes.
What about her manner with regard to sexual matters? Does she make jokes? Sexual jokes, innuendos, ribald comments?
No, never.
Body language? Flirtatious. Does she touch people?
Not really. She certainly knows she's good-looking, and she can play on that. But her manner is kind of cool. She's the Grace Kelly type.
They say Grace Kelly was very sexually active, that she had affairs with most of her leading men.
I wouldn't know.
Uh-huh. What about Ms. Johnson? Does she have affairs inside the company?
I wouldn't know. I haven't heard anything.
Fernandez flipped to a new page on her pad. All right. And how long has she been your supervisor? Or is she your supervisor?
Yes, she is. One day.
For the first time, Fernandez looked surprised. She glanced at him and took another bite of her sandwich.
One day? Yes. Yesterday was the first day of a new company organization. She had just been appointed.
So the day she is appointed, she meets with you in the evening?
Yes.
All right. You were telling me you were sitting on the couch and she was kissing you. And what happened then?
She unzipped. Well, first of all, she started rubbing me.
Your genitals?
Yes, and kissing me.
He found himself sweating. He wiped his forehead with his hand. I understand this is difficult. I'll try to make this as brief as possible, Fernandez said. And then?
Then she unzipped my pants and started rubbing me with her hand.
Was your penis exposed?
Yes.
Who exposed it?
She took it out.
So she took your penis out of your pants and then rubbed it with her hand. Is that right?
She peered at him over her glasses, and for a moment he glanced away in embarrassment. But when he looked back at her, he saw that she was not the least embarrassed, that her manner was more than clinical, more than professional, that she was in some deep way detached and very cold. Yes, he said. That's what happened.
And what was your reaction?
Well, he gave an embarrassed shrug. It worked.
You were sexually aroused?
Yes.
Did you say anything to her?
Like what?
I'm just asking whether you said anything to her.
Like what? I don't know.
Did you say anything at all?
I said something. I don't know. I was feeling very uncomfortable.
Do you remember what you said?
I think I just kept saying, Meredith, trying to get her to stop, you know, but she kept interrupting me or kissing me.
Did you say anything else besides Meredith?
I don't remember.
How did you feel about what she was doing?
I felt uncomfortable.
Why?
I was afraid of getting involved with her, because she was my boss now, and because I was married now and I didn't want any complications in my life. You know, an office affair.
Why not? Fernandez asked.
The question took him aback. Why not?
Yes.
She looked at him directly, her eyes cool, appraising.
After all, you're alone with a beautiful woman. Why not have an affair?
Jesus.
It's a question most people would ask.
I'm married.
So what? Married people have affairs all the time.
Well, he said, for one thing, my wife is a lawyer and very suspicious.
Do I know her?
Her name is Susan Handler. She's with Lyman King.
Fernandez nodded. I've heard of her. So, you were afraid that she would find out?
Sure. I mean, you have an affair in the office and everybody's going to know. There isn't any way to keep it quiet.
So you were concerned about this becoming known?
Yes, but that wasn't the main reason.
What was the main reason?
She was my boss. I didn't like the position I was in. She was, you know, well, she had the right to fire me, if she wanted to. So it was like I had to do it. I was very uncomfortable.
Did you tell her that?
I tried.
How did you try?
Well, I just tried.
Would you say that you indicated to her that her advances were not welcome?
Eventually, yes.
How is that?
Well, eventually we continued this, whatever you call it, foreplay or whatever, and she had her panties off and...
I'm sorry, how did she come to have her panties off?
I took them off.
Did she ask you to do that?
No, but I got pretty worked up at one point. I was going to do it, or at least I was thinking about doing it.
You were going to have intercourse.
Her voice again cool, the pen scratching. Yes.
You were a willing participant.
For a while there, yes.
In what way were you a willing participant? She asked. What I mean is, did you initiate touching her body or breast or genitals without her encouragement?
I don't know. She was pretty much encouraging everything.
I am asking, did you volunteer? Did you do it on your own, or did she, for example, take your hand and place it on her?
No, I did it on my own.
What about your earlier reservations?
I was worked up, excited. I didn't care at that point.
All right, go on.
He wiped his forehead. I'm being very honest with you.
That's exactly what you should be. It's the best thing all around. Please go on.
And she was lying on the couch with her skirt pulled up, and she wanted me to enter her, to... And she was sort of moaning, you know, saying, no, no, and suddenly I had this feeling again that I didn't want to do this. So I said, okay, let's not. And I got off the couch and started getting dressed.
You broke off from the encounter yourself?
Yes.
Because she had said no?
No, that was just an excuse. Because I was feeling uneasy at that point.
Uh-huh. So you got off the couch and started to get dressed?
Yes.
And did you say anything at that time to explain your actions?
Yes, I said that I didn't think this was a good idea, and I didn't feel good about it.
And how did she respond?
She got very angry. She started throwing things at me. Then she started hitting me and scratching me.
Do you have any marks?
Yes.
Where are they?
On my neck and chest.
Have they been photographed yet?
No.
All right. Now, when she scratched you, how did you respond?
I just tried to get dressed and get out of there.
You didn't respond directly to her attack?
Well, at one point I pushed her back to get her away from me, and she tripped on a table and fell on the floor.
You make it sound like pushing her was self-defense on your part.
It was. She was ripping the buttons off my shirt. I had to go home, and I didn't want my wife to see my shirt, so I pushed her away.
Did you ever do anything that was not self-defense?
No.
Did you hit her at any time?
No.
You're sure about that?
Yes.
All right. What happened then?
She threw a wine glass at me. By then I was pretty much dressed. I went and got my phone from her windowsill, and then I went...
I'm sorry, you got your phone? What phone is that?
I had a cellular phone. He took it out of his pocket and showed her. We all carry them in the company, because we make them, and I had been using the phone to make a call from her office when she started kissing me.
Were you in the middle of a call when she started kissing you?
Yes.
Whom were you talking to?
An answering machine.
I see.
She was clearly disappointed.
Go on, please.
So I went and got my phone and got the hell out of there. She was screaming that I couldn't do this to her, that she would kill me.
And you responded how?
Nothing. I just left.
And this was at what time?
About 6:45.
Did anybody see you leave?
The cleaning lady.
Do you happen to know her name?
No.
Ever seen her before?
No.
Do you think she worked for your company?
She had a company uniform on. You know, for the maintenance firm that cleans up our offices.
Uh-huh. And then?
He shrugged. I went home.
Did you tell your wife what happened?
No.
Did you tell anybody what happened?
No.
Why not?
I guess I was in shock.
She paused and looked back over her notes.
All right, you say you were sexually harassed, and you have described a very direct overture by this woman. Since she was your boss, I would have thought you'd feel yourself at some risk in turning her down.
Well, I was concerned. Sure. But I mean, don't I have the right to turn her down? Isn't that what this is about?
Certainly you have that right. I'm asking about your state of mind.
I was very upset.
Yet you did not want to tell anybody what had happened? You did not want to share this upsetting experience with a colleague, a friend, a family member, perhaps a brother, anybody at all?
No, it didn't even occur to me. I didn't know how to deal with what... I guess I was in shock. I just wanted it to go away. I wanted to think it had never happened.
Did you make any notes?
No.
All right. Now, you mentioned that you didn't tell your wife. Would you say you concealed it from your wife?
He hesitated.
Yes. Do you often conceal things from her?
No. But in this instance, you know, involving an old girlfriend, I didn't think she would be sympathetic. I didn't want to deal with her about this.
Have you had other affairs?
This wasn't an affair.
I'm asking a general question in terms of your relationship to your wife.
No, I haven't had affairs.
All right. I advise you to tell your wife at once, make a full and complete disclosure, because I promise you that she will find out, if she hasn't done so already. However difficult it may be to tell her, your best chance to preserve your relationship is to be completely honest with her.
Okay.
Now, going back to last night, what happened next?
Meredith Johnson called the house and spoke to my wife.
Fernandez's eyebrows went up. I see. Did you expect that to happen?
God, no. It scared the hell out of me. But apparently she was friendly and just called to say that the morning meeting was scheduled for 8:30, today.
I see.
But when I got to work today, I found that the meeting had actually been scheduled for 8.
So you arrived late and were embarrassed and so on?
Yes.
And you believe that it was a setup?
Yes.
Fernandez glanced at her watch. I'm afraid I'm running out of time. Bring the wallet.
Harry, Herbatten, Orton, TFD.
Without mentioning Conley White, he described the morning meeting briefly and his subsequent humiliation. His argument with Meredith. His conversation with Phil Blackburn. The offer of a lateral transfer. The fact that the transfer would deny him the benefits of a possible spinoff. His decision to seek advice. Fernandez asked few questions and wrote steadily. Finally, she pushed the yellow pad aside. All right, I think I have enough to get the picture. You're feeling slighted and ignored, and your question is, do you have a harassment case?
Yes, he said, nodding.
Well, arguably you do. It's a jury case, and we don't know what would happen if we went to trial. But based on what you have told me here, I have to advise you that your case is not strong.
Sanders felt stunned.
Jesus. I don't make the law. I'm just telling you frankly, so you can arrive at an informed decision. Your situation is not good, Mr. Sanders.
End of side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over.